Well, I suppose I am an academic, so I'm vice president of Mary Eye at the moment. Before that, I was in UCC. I spent a lot of time doing research on kind of inequality, social exclusion, all those kinds of issues. Some of it indeed was done in Clare and in Ennis. And I suppose over that period of time, I've always done work in the media with a view to kind of trying to push those things through forward to policy. And that proved very challenging. We've had a lot of successes, but like it can take 10 years between getting a piece of research out and actually getting it through to policy. And I come from a political family. My father was Fine Gael councillor and mayor of Limerick, and my sister's Green Party TD. And I suppose I have always been struck with how much politicians can actually do. I know many people on the ground often go, oh, sure, they're a waste of time and they're not doing anything. But actually politicians who make their minds up, I think it was really interesting even listening to John Wall there earlier on, and he kind of described that long road, you know, going to meet Simon Harris, going to meet Stephen Donnelly. But eventually change happened, and change that was really significant for a lot of people. So I suppose in that sense, I kind of felt at some point, will I dip my toe in the water? And here I am.
So as an academic, you've seen the change that needs to be made, but it's more difficult to affect the change. As you mentioned, you come from a political family, your dad, Michael, and also your sister, Nasa. You know, one was a councillor, one was a TD. You're running for the European Parliament. There will be differences, but you, seeing them at work, talking to them, have you also sought their advice in the run-in to deciding to run for the European elections, even in terms of which your sister, you know, be running as a woman in politics? Just all the particular aspects that will be involved in this and what to expect.
I suppose I'm very fortunate. My dad, his brother actually is parish priest in Lissy Casey, Father Joe Harrigan, so we spent a lot of time in Clare, and he has a great knowledge of the kind of on the ground of politics, so to speak, getting out there, meeting people, talking to people, listening to their concerns. My sister, I suppose, is of a different generation in politics, where social media is a much bigger force, where women in politics have to deal with social media, and she's been a great support to me on that. I have to say, though, Alan, that I think for me, you know, coming to the European campaign in particular, I suppose given my background as an academic, I taught courses on European societies and globalisation, and so I suppose I bring a certain knowledge of that. The other thing, I suppose, and I think this is something that comes up for all European candidates on the door, people say, well, what does Europe actually mean to me? What difference does Europe make? Why should I care about
Europe?
We're
a small fish in a big pond. Yeah. What change can you really expect to make?
Exactly. But, you know, I was here last weekend. We had a very good meeting, myself and Jed Nash, with members of the Ennis Chamber of Commerce. And the single biggest issue for all those retailers and business people in Clare was housing. Housing for their staff, housing so that people can live in Ennis and come in and spend money and relax. The impact that very high rents were taking on people in terms of their disposable income. Now, people often, because I have housing as kind of core part of my campaign agenda, people say, well, what can Europe do about housing? But actually, Europe is a big part of the problem in our housing crisis. So, for instance, here in Clare right now, we've nearly 3,000 people who are on the housing waiting list. The most significant way and the most effective way to drill down into those and to take those people out of the equation, and indeed to stop councils competing with first-time buyers for the new builds that are available, which is also a big problem, is for councils to direct build housing themselves. If we look at the history of Ireland in the 30s and the 50s and 60s, when we built loads of social housing, it was because councils built them directly themselves. The reason why councils struggle or are unable to build directly themselves, particularly on a large scale, is because they're inhibited from borrowing by the EU fiscal rules. So actually, the EU fiscal rules are a very significant part, because we know that local authorities and IPAS and other agencies competing with first-time buyers is making it hugely difficult for people who would, you know, like I am of the generation, I suppose, in the night, in some ways the last generation in Ireland, of people who are able to buy housing with reasonably normal incomes. That's because so many of us bought new builds in estates kind of off the plans. That's gone now because so many people who are at that stage that I was then are competing with the state, when the state should be building its own houses. It shouldn't be buying the houses that developers are producing at
and
all.
And you're making a good point there, because I think some people are still under the perception that it's people versus vulture funds for housing, but is it the state versus the people?
Well, it is. And certainly I would be of the view that the state could do a lot more. And again, this is where, you know, they will say, well, EU competition law doesn't allow us to set boundaries with vulture funds. But again, the EU could do a lot to support the state in terms of anti-speculation policies. Like the point I will always make, Alan, is if we look at the origin of the CAP policy, which we were, any of us are familiar with the CAP, that was all about food security. That was about ensuring that Europeans had enough to eat, because food is a basic need. But shelter is also a basic need. And I would be of the view, and the group that Labour belonged to in the European Parliament, the SNDs, would be of the view that housing is a basic need, and that Europe should be part of the solution in terms of housing security. We all need shelter. We can't survive without it.
So how that, and that is a question people might be asking. Well, okay, you could affect change through Europe as an MEP, but you would be one sole MEP. Would it be through, it would be through the grouping that you might be able to affect change? How significant is that particular grouping that Labour is a part of?
I suppose, because we're all familiar with the Dáil, and we're all familiar with the role of, you know, independence in the Dáil, which, and we heard Michael talking earlier on, and, you know, in a sense, he's a very powerful independent voice here in Clare. But nevertheless, you're limited in what you can do if you're not part of a bigger political party. The European Parliament just works in exactly the same way. The two biggest groups are the EPP, which Fine Gael is part of, and the Socialists and Democrats, which Labour is part of. We're the only party, Irish party, that is aligned with the Socialists and Democrats. And because we've no Labour MEP at the moment, we have no voice in the second biggest group in the European Parliament. And to be honest with you, to affect change, to make differences on like things like Mercosur and things like housing, you need to be part of the big group. I mean, we know that lesson from our own politics, and it works the same up in Europe, unfortunately.
So housing is one of the big priorities for you. And I mean, like, we were only talking with Midwest Simon Community yesterday about, you know, they were saying that at least a quarter of whatever housing is built by the government needs to be social affordable housing. But, you know, Simon Harris, on foot of becoming Taoiseach, is promising to build 50,000 homes a year from 2025 to 2030. I think Ivana Bacic mentioned 50,000 a target. But even though the government have said, you know, the number of houses we're building each year is increasing, it's still well off that target. How likely do you think it is that we will be building 50,000 homes a year? Because even some housing experts say actually the 58,000 is really the minimum point we need the goal. Even reaching 50 seems a lofty ambition. Some would say unrealistic.
I think there's two elements of the drill down here that need a lot more attention. So first of all, in terms of the state building housing, it's actually about 10% in cost-wise more efficient for the state to directly build housing itself than to partner with a developer to build housing. That's a significant difference in cost. So I would be arguing that the state should be getting off the table with developers altogether. Developers should be building housing for people out there on the market. Vultures should be inhibited from coming in and gobbling up all that housing. And the state should be direct building its own housing. But I suppose the other issue, Alan, for me, and, you know, I taught in UCC for many years, and I was working there in 2011 when the housing crisis, when the banking crisis hit. And we saw a lot of people come into college at that point. And in many cases, there were mature students, people who had worked as carpenters, as electricians, as fitters. They were often third and fourth generations of their family who worked in those trades. And I was doing research on the banking crisis at the time, and I met and talked to a lot of them. And so many of them said to me, Niamh, I would never encourage a son or daughter of mine to go into a trade, because they were left hanging when that banking crisis hit. So many of them had to go to Australia, they had to go back, they weren't even entitled to social welfare. And I think that's a missing piece in terms of the reluctance of people to go back into trades now, which in many cases are really, I mean, quite frankly, if you go into a trade now and you do it right, you'll be earning more than if you do a PhD. Mm. But that lesson isn't out there. And I think there's a big piece of work around apprenticeships. Apprentices themselves should be entitled to minimum wage. They work damn hard, as we all know. But there's a bigger piece in terms of creating those safety nets for people who say, okay, if I do become a plumber, if I do become an electrician, if the whole thing goes bust in the morning, we you know, in my lifetime, there's been three really, if you think about the 70s, three significant busts. It's a huge ask to ask somebody to go in and borrow for a mortgage, you know, get all their kids going, and then the whole thing could go bust in the morning. What are the assurances for them? So I personally feel in a sense, we can get caught up in a big row about targets until we start drilling down into why we still have so few people going into apprenticeships and why our costs are so high and how we could do it cheaper. And direct building is one way we could do it cheaper. We're never going to solve these issues. We're never going to get those numbers really up.
One of the other priorities for you is neutrality, and it's felt like over the last number of years there'd be ever more and more opinion pieces on how Ireland needs to strengthen our army or military or defence, and a lot of talk around us remaining neutral in Europe. You want to protect Irish neutrality, and you know there's a lot of talk about the triple lock as well.
Yeah,
the government wants to change that. They deny that removing the triple lock erodes our neutrality. Do you feel differently?
Well, I think we're in a very complicated place with our neutrality. So the way we operate neutrality is complicated in the first place, because we're militarily neutral.
Someone say a bit hypocritical.
Well, we're militarily neutral, but we're not politically neutral. So, you know, if we look at the last 6 months, you know, the government has come out, and indeed I and the Labour Party and many other people have come out and made very strong statements, you know, in support of the Palestinians, for instance. But at the same time, we don't position ourselves as a military entity. I suppose the concern for me, Alan, really, and it really emanates from the European peace in the last year, is that we saw Ursula von der Leyen at the beginning of that conflict come out and make very strong statements on behalf of the EU, which then Michael T. Higgins, who of course is a former Labour Party minister, had to come out and say, actually, hang on a minute, you don't have the authority to make those statements. We then saw what, in my view, is a kind of a slide in government to say, look, we need to get rid of the triple lock. You know, we had this big forum in Cork. And, you know, a number of people said to me, well, you know, Irish people, we don't take neutrality seriously. We don't invest in it. But I actually feel Irish people do take our neutrality seriously. But I do think, first of all, if we were to move from that position, we need a referendum. Everybody needs to have a say. But second of all, that I do think we need to invest in a credible neutrality. So, like, we haven't had a minister for defence for 14 years. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Our defence forces are Trina Kayla.
Yeah, you're saying we need to take our neutrality seriously. Do we need to take our defence forces seriously? Even like the first element of the triple lock, Niamh, you know, need a UN resolution seeking international force assistance for any location. You know, a requirement for UN approval, does it needlessly tie us to a body that realistically, it's passing fewer resolutions because of big power vetoes. You know, mm-hmm. hypothetically, you know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, there could be a situation there where we might want to send Irish troops in to defend Ukraine, but they put it to a vote in the UN, and there's one objector, and it's Russia. And Russia could stop us from sending troops to fight Russia, which just seems ludicrous.
Well, is it? If we're neutral, I suppose this is the point.
But should we be neutral, particularly with the changing geopolitics and in Europe as well?
My own view is that as long as neutrality is our official position, then the triple lock is part of that. I think if we move from a position of neutrality, then the triple lock moves with that. Quite frankly, I think in the first instance, our focus on defence is quite frankly erroneous. I think we need much stronger focus on security, because right now, because of the lack of investment in the defence forces, because of the lack of representation at the cabinet table, we have a huge security issue. I was talking to a member of the Defence Forces down in Kilkenny last week, and he was saying, you know, forget about us being able to defend ourselves in the event of a war.
We'd expect others to defend us.
Let's talk about right now. Like, at the moment, we are not really able to provide security in our own waters, even though there's fibre optic cable going under our seas that has such global
RAF patrolling our skies.
And we also are very weak in terms of cybersecurity. So the first step for us, in my view, is a credible neutrality where we invest in our own security. And that's, I suppose, what I'm arguing for in the first instance.
Does it just seem a bit like, it seemed a bit like wanting to have our cake and eat it, and that we want to remain neutral, but if we were attacked, we'd expect some of our European allies or other allies to come in and help defend us. But if they were in a similar position, we wouldn't be able to militarily support them. And was neutrality maybe just, you know, you go back to the foundation of the Irish state, the Irish Free State. Was neutrality just about really distinguishing ourselves from Britain rather than actually an ideological principle? And we're just clinging on to it now in the 21st century when times are different.
I think our neutrality, Alan, is deeply rooted in our colonial history. I don't, you know, there is a view out there that it's not thought through. I think it's deeply felt if it's not thought through. And I certainly think it's something that we need to talk about more in terms of if we're going to actually be neutral. And I personally believe that we should be. It has to be credible. You know, we have to be Austria. We cannot continue to be Ireland and kind of essentially rely on everybody else. I do think, and you know, we are seeing the global geopolitical thing really change. There is undoubtedly going to be further developments in common security and defence policy, and Ireland will be part of those to a certain extent. And that's why I think we need a much bigger debate and much stronger representation in terms of getting there and saying, okay, if we are neutral, and we are, how do we navigate this piece in terms of security? Because security is not negotiable. It's not something that you can say, oh, well, we're neutral, so we don't need security. We may not decide to be military active, but we have to be able to mind our own patch. And right now we can't.
Okay. Last messages to potential voters as you seek their vote for June 7th?
Well, one thing that is really critical in Ireland South is that all our MEPs right now are basically down south. They're down in Cork and Kerry. We've had no MEP in the Midwest since Alan Kelly actually won in 2009. And that's a huge loss to the Midwest. You know, one of the things about this part of Clare and Limerick in particular, I live on the Clare side of Limerick, and we spent our lives going in and out of Shannon Airport and Bunratty, etc. It's a very outward looking part of the country. It's very sophisticated in terms of its regional development, and it really needs to be part of that bigger geopolitical conversation in terms of it, both the national economy and the international economy. We need representation in the Midwest. We need an MEP in the Midwest. So that's why I'd be asking voters in Clare to consider me.